If you have your Bible or a way to access your Bible, you've got the app or a tablet or something. We're going to be in John 4:43 this morning, John 4:43. And our series that we're beginning this morning is called I Need a Miracle. You know, sooner or later in your life, you may literally say those words, I need a miracle. I could really use a miracle, like a real miracle in your life. The story that we're going to look at this morning is of a man who definitely needs a miracle. Unfortunately, in my life, I've been in those situations with people who really didn't need miracles or wanted miracles. When I was in high school, there was a man in our community. He was an upstanding man. He was a Christian man. Late 40s, his kids went to school with me. When I went off to college, he was still an influential guy in the community, went out running one night, went to bed, didn't wake up the next morning. I remember going over to the house, and I remember seeing the shock look on his wife's face as she literally said those words, I need a miracle. And it's really sort of frustrating in life, isn't it, that sometimes when we say that I need a miracle, and it's like God doesn't do that in that moment, we're sort of left struggling and wondering about how to deal with that. But the man that we meet in this story, he'll receive a miracle. But the greatest miracle that this man experiences isn't the sign and wonder that happens. It's something else. It's the answer to a question. And this is the question of this story. Do you believe? John 4:43 says that after the 2 days, he left for Galilee. We're kind of joining Jesus on a journey here. You know, he leaves Jerusalem, he goes to Samaria, meets a woman at a well, he spends 2 days there. And after 2 days, he left for Galilee. He's going north to Galilee, going to his hometown. He's going to Galilee where he grew up in Nazareth and all that. He's going to Galilee. Now it says, and it just kind of places it in the Bible parenthetically, and it's kind of like, well, then that must not be very important, but as it turns out, this little subtle text becomes really helpful to understand what's happening here. It says, now Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. And when he arrived in Galilee, which was, by the way, what? His own country. The Galileans welcomed him. I said in the earlier service, I wish the Bible had the same kind of things you can do on your phone when you're sending a comment to somebody. You can say, I'm just kidding, smiley face. This is one of those moments. The Galileans welcomed him. Yeah, they said, come on, Jesus. But that doesn't mean they believed in him. It doesn't mean they trusted him. It doesn't mean that they accepted him. In fact, it even goes on to say that they had seen the things that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, for they had been there. They'd seen Jesus do some amazing things. But remember, he's without honor in his own hometown, in his own country. And then it says this in verse 46, once more he visited Cana in Galilee. Everybody knows Cana in Galilee for the very reason the text tells us. This is where he had turned the water into wine. Earlier in the gospel, he had done this miracle. Lots of wine, lots and lots of wine. It was a big deal. It was a sign that the age of the Messiah had come. And then the story says this, and there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. And this is, you know, about a day's journey away. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and he begged him to come and to heal his son who was close to death. His son was laying sick. He wasn't just sick, he was laying sick. You know how sometimes you're sick and you just kind of sit there watching TV? He was laying sick. He was about to die. In a sense, you could say he was coming to Jesus to say, I need a miracle. Look what Jesus says, verse 48. Unless you people see signs and wonders, Jesus said, you're never going to believe. The royal official said, sir, come down before my child dies. Hey, come over to my house and fix him. Go, Jesus said, your son will live. And I love this line. Mark it, underline it, circle it. The man took Jesus at his word and he departed. That's what faith looks like. While he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that his boy, and here's this word boy used for the first time. It means sort of this darling son, this boy that he put on his lap. Not a teenager, but a little boy. Maybe his firstborn son. He was alive. He was living. When he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, yesterday at 1 in the afternoon, the fever left him. Then the father realized that that was the exact time at which his son, which Jesus had said to him, your son will live. So he and his whole household did what? Believed. And this was the second sign Jesus performed after coming from Judea to Galilee. The Easter question, do you believe? How do you make sense out of a story like this? Well, I guess you look at some of the details of it. First, you say, who is this guy? Look, who he is. He is, according to the text, a royal official. That means that he works for someone who is a king. The man in charge of Galilee was Herod Antipas. He was Herod the Great's son. He had a capital just on the other side of the mountain from where Jesus had grown up in Nazareth. But he had moved it out so it could be on the shore of the Sea of Galilee at Tiberias. And he could look out across the shore, across Galilee, and he could see Capernaum. That's where this man was from. Capernaum was a town right on the edge of the boundary between the country. And it was on the major road called the Via Maris, the big highway. And what they did is they had people out there to collect a toll tax as you went by. All right, pay your tax for this and that. So there was a big tax station there. There was also Roman military that were there, a centurion, 100 Roman soldiers run by a centurion. So it was a military town. And this man lived there, some kind of royal official. Maybe he was involved in all of that. Maybe he was involved in the taxes or in the military or in the city government. I don't know. But one thing I suspect is he was most likely an employee of the Roman government. In other words, he's somebody who's associated with the Roman government. Jews don't like to do much with that. They don't want to be in contact with people like that. And therefore, this man is most likely a Gentile. Now, we've already learned in the gospel as we read through it that Jews don't associate with Samaritans, and Jesus does. He talks to the woman at the well. But what's even worse is to come in contact with a Gentile. I mean, worse than Samaritans were Gentiles. Worse cooties than the Samaritans were the Gentile cooties. You don't want Gentile cooties. You don't eat with Gentiles. You don't even go into a Gentile's home. You don't associate with Gentiles because that stuff rubs off on you, you know. And Jews don't have anything to do with that. And this is what's so incredible in this moment, that it's this guy, this royal official, this sinner, this Gentile, this guy is the one who comes to Jesus. And we remember what it says in verse 44. Jesus pointed out to them that a prophet was out of honor in his own country. It wasn't the Canaanites, the people living in Cana, if you will, coming to him. It was this man. In fact, this is a very interesting moment in the Bible. And you may wonder to yourself, like, why? Like, why don't the Jews ask Jesus to help them or to heal them? And the answer is, they grew up with him, right? You ever heard the old saying, familiarity breeds contempt? You know something, you first get married. Some of you have been married, some of you are married. You know, you first get married and you go home with your wife or your husband, whatever. And, oh, I love you so much. Do you want me to clean for you? Want me to cook for you? You want me to fill the car up with gas? And then after you're married for a few years, it's kind of like, do it yourself. All of a sudden, all the nice sort of runs off, and the familiarity kind of breeds. We do that with God, don't we? You know, we come to church, we kind of get used to church, we get used to the Bible, and we sometimes take it for granted that, you know, when we walk in here today, God is in here. He inhabits the praises of his people. This place becomes holy ground when we sing and we worship him. He's in this place. Familiarity will breed contempt. And that's what they did to Jesus. They grew up with him. They rubbed shoulders with him. They've known him all of his life. You know, they say things like, well, he went to school with my boys. He's just a carpenter's son. Matthew's gospel records it. It says in Matthew 13 that they took offense at him, but Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his own town. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? But then he added this. And he did not do many miracles there because of their lack of faith. He didn't do miracles in his own town, among his own people, because they didn't believe in him. I've come to realize something as I was reading that this week, and it's kind of controversial, so you might want to think about whether or not it's true. But in the Bible, God answers the prayers of sinners. It's good because we're all sinners. But he doesn't answer the prayers of unbelievers. In the book of Hebrews, it says that it is impossible to please God unless you believe in him. You don't believe in him, you're not going to even talk to him. Faith is essential in this moment for the miracle to happen. In fact, this whole Gospel of John has been trying to say that from the very beginning to the very end. It opened with this scene in John 1. It says, he came unto that which was his own, John 1:11, but his own did not receive him. He came to his own people, but they rejected him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed, he gave the right to become the children of God. You see, this gospel is asking a question this morning. Do you believe? Now look where he's at. Look where he is. I guess I could have said look where he is at, between the A and the T. Look where he is in this story. Where is he at? The text tells us that he is in Cana of Galilee. He's in the very place where he has turned water into wine. He's in the place where the great miracle of abundance has happened. He's in the place where people should say, yeah, I know he's the Messiah because I saw what he did. But they don't. And a man from far away, from Capernaum, a Gentile, a Roman guy, he shows up in Cana. He comes, you might say it like this, far from home to find Jesus. I wonder this morning, are you on a journey to find Jesus? Are you on a quest? Are you looking to find Jesus today? This man went out to find him. He left Capernaum. He comes to Canaan, and he gets there. It's an interesting moment in the gospel because it shows us something about this man's heart. Put yourself in his shoes. His son is dying. He's desperate. He would do anything to save his own son's life. And it's a realization in this moment. Desperation can be a source of faith. When you realize you actually need God can be a moment where all of a sudden you start to believe in God. Jordan Spieth is a professional golfer. And he's a good golfer because he's from Texas. Jordan Spieth is also a Christian, and he made the comment this week or so ago that there's something about him that not everybody knows. He said, and that is that I am in desperate need of God every day of my life. And you wonder today, do we realize how much we desperately need God every day? Do we realize how much we need God right here and right now? So many times in the Bible, the reason, and it's true here, that people don't experience the miracle is because they don't have the faith. They've been hemmed in by their fears. They've been hemmed in by their doubts. They've been hemmed in. They're like an animal in the zoo. You ever see the animals in the zoo? You don't normally see them running around. They pretty much stay in there. Take an example of an African impala. It's kind of like a deer. An African impala can jump up 10 feet in the air. It can leap out 30 feet in front of it. But you put an impala in the zoo with a 3-foot fence and it'll never jump out. The people who make the zoos, the people who capture the animals, they understand the psychology of an impala. They know that an impala will never jump where it cannot see its landing. It's almost a mirror of our lives sometimes, isn't it? We're sort of like that. Okay, God, I'll trust you as far as I can jump. I'll trust you as far as I can see. And our lives are enclosed by our fears. We're trapped by our doubts and by the facts. And we don't know that we could be set free if we could just believe. Look where he's at. But then finally, look when it is. Look when it is. He comes the next day. He leaves Cana. He goes back to Capernaum. And he goes back and he meets his son, he finds everything is okay, and he discovers that the miracle happened at the exact time that Jesus said that it would. It happens at 1 o'clock the previous afternoon, which I think is really interesting because in the story, the man doesn't just like immediately go from Jesus to his son. He doesn't like get on the first horse and say, I'm gonna go check it out and see if he's okay. In fact, what the text tells us is this. He takes Jesus at his word, and he departed. One of the greatest signs of faith anywhere in the Bible is found in this man. And it's found in those words, that he takes Jesus at his word. It is, in a sense, the definition of faith. It's what faith really looks like. You're taking Jesus at his word. I got to be honest with you. I'm not sure I would have done that. If I would have gone to Jesus and he said, go, your son is well, I might have said, Jesus, just to be sure, would you mind coming with me? Like, would you mind traveling and making sure everything's okay with my boy? But he departs. And he doesn't run. He waits the next day before he even goes back. There's so much faith in this man. It's absolutely incredible. And he's not a Jew. He's a sinner. He's an outsider. But in this story, we're told that it has a very important meaning. Verse 54, this was the second sign Jesus performed after coming from Judea to Galilee. It is a sign. In the gospel, Jesus will perform a series of these. He'll not only turn water to wine, but he'll do this miracle. Later, he'll turn bread and feed the thousands. He'll walk on the water. He'll raise Lazarus. And the signs will run out. There are 7 of them. And then you get to the last chapters of the book. And in chapter 20, there's one more miracle left. It's when Mary and those other ladies this morning come to the tomb. And they're on their way to pay their final respects. They're going to a funeral, folks. And when they get there, the stone's rolled away and they can't figure it out. They're upset. They're concerned. They've been crying. They wonder where they put the body of Jesus. They tell Peter. He runs to the tomb. And then Mary discovers what's happened. And Peter discovers what's happened. And then a week later, Thomas, who said, I won't believe unless I see, sees and he believes. And he falls down and he says, my Lord and my God. And then the gospel ends. It's over. It stops. The gospel comes to an abrupt end. And then these are the words, John chapter 20, verse 30 and 31. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. Like, he did a lot of other stuff, but these are the ones that he's written down. These, he says, are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. These 7 ones were written so that you would believe. And the question of the text is, do you believe? In 1893, George Ferris stood in front of the object that he had just engineered and designed. It is called the Ferris wheel. In 1893, he had brought along the press. He had brought along his wife. And he was telling everybody about this really great thing called the Ferris wheel. Wouldn't it be great to take a ride on a Ferris wheel? Except for it was a windy day in June and nobody had the guts to get on his new invention. So what did he do? Well, he's an engineer. He explained, this is how it was built, and it's sturdy, and you can get on it, and don't worry about it. Went through all the facts, all the figures. Didn't convince anybody. So George Ferris had to do what Jesus did. He had to step into his own creation and take a ride. After that, people have been going on Ferris wheels ever since. Jesus entered into human history, into the world that he created, and he died on the cross. And he rose from the dead. And the question this morning is, do you believe? Not do you believe in the facts and the figures and the statistics, not just sitting there going, yeah, amen, I like that, let's hear another song. But I mean, have you, like George Ferris, have you stepped into it, into faith? Do you have a personal experience with the Jesus of the resurrection?